This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. As a candidate, President Donald Trump seemed to strike a decidedly non-interventionist tone. He called the Iraq War a disaster. He talked about strengthening borders, putting up walls, putting America first. But today, he tweeted, quote, "Iran has been formally put on notice," all capitals, "for firing a ballistic missile." The president didn't offer further detail or clarification. So in a sense, this mighty ebb and flow that we might be seeing in Donald Trump between the projection and retraction of American power, well, that struggle has actually been with us as long as there has been an America. In his new book, author Stephen Kinzer says the defining moment in that struggle actually came in the late 19th and early 20th centuries and is perfectly embodied by two Americans in particular, President Theodore Roosevelt and writer Mark Twain. Stephen Kinzer's new book is The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire, and he joins us now in the studio. Stephen Kinzer, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be here.
Okay, so first of all, let me ask you, what was it about this particular moment in time, the late 19th and early 20th century, that you feel was such a defining moment in American history?
The story of how the United States became such an interventionist power has always interested me. So we are the country that intervenes more often in more countries further away from our borders than any other nation. How did this happen? Why did we become this way? Most historians look for the answer to that question in the period after World War II. Mm-hmm. That's when we became a global empire. But I think it actually starts earlier. I think you have to look back to the period of 1898, 1899, when we had our first burst of expansionism. So we had reached the edge of the North American continent. We'd been expanding more or less ever since the Pilgrims landed. Then came this enormous question. Do we stop here? So in 1898, the U.S. changed probably more dramatically than in any year in its history. At the beginning of that year, we were pretty peacefully happy within our own borders. And then, within a matter of months, we had been whipped into a fervor of international eagerness to intervene. And by the end of that year, we found ourselves in possession of foreign territories, some quite distant from the U.S. So what I've discovered, and that's the center of this book, is that this enormous decision the United States made, and indeed one senator called it the greatest question that has ever been presented to the American people, was made by very narrow margins, and the entire United States was caught up in a huge debate over whether this was a good idea. Every major political and intellectual figure took part. So having spent all this time now immersed in my research, reading the congressional records, looking at the newspapers and magazines of that day, I realized that the whole U.S. was caught up in this debate, and it tells me that our argument today over whether we should intervene or not really all begins back then.
Okay, so remind us, for those of us who don't remember explicitly, honestly, in the course of preparing for today's conversation, I had to reach back to high school history. 1898, we're talking about the Spanish-American War, and the lands that you said the United States suddenly was lording over were Philippines, right, in part?
Essentially, here's what happened in a nutshell. Cuban rebels were fighting to overthrow Spanish colonialism. At this point, Henry Cabot Lodge, one of the great planners of the imperial project, and Theodore Roosevelt were eager to get America into the imperialism business. They wanted the U.S. to control the world. The third member of their triumvirate, William Randolph Hearst, used his newspapers to whip Americans into a fervor about the oppressions that were going on in Cuba. And many of those stories were what we would now call fake news. We know that stories in which reporters said they were literally watching brutalized Cubans die in front of their faces were written by reporters that had never even been in Cuba. So we decided to go in and fight in Cuba alongside the Cuban rebels. But before we fought, we wanted to get rid of the Spanish fleet to make sure it wouldn't attack the U.S. in retribution. So we looked around the world for where it was, and the Spanish fleet turned out to be in a place that no American had ever heard of, and that was the Philippines. So we sent a squadron there and sank the Spanish fleet. And then we didn't know, so what do we do with the Philippines?
Yeah.
Do we take it? And at the end of 1898, we decided we would. So we signed a treaty with Spain under which we got Guam, Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and Cuba was also let out of Spanish rule. And then the U.S. Senate had to ratify this treaty. The Senate went out on a 32-day debate that is so articulate, so sophisticated, that it transported me as I felt I was maybe the first person in 50 years to be reading through this spectacular debate, which really encapsulates all the themes that we argue on both sides today.
Okay. I want to explore those themes in just a moment here, but let's get to the two names that are in the title of your book, the two men who embody this debate that sees the nation in the late 19th and early 20th century. I just want to read a tiny little graph from the book. And again, the book is called The True Flag. Stephen Kinzer, this it really captured me. It says, "This was the most popular war in American history. Thanks to the telegraph, it was also the first one Americans were able to follow as it was being fought, reading about battles while they were still underway. The yellow press crackled with frenzied energy. Boatloads of correspondents flooded into Cuba. They needed heroes. And the blunt-talking, buck-toothed, hyperactive Roosevelt fit the role perfectly."
Roosevelt was a figure who really encapsulated the American desire for adventure and color. He was a great believer that war was the only decent condition for a nation and a man, and believed that the U.S. had a sacred mission. As he once said, "Our flag is a proud flag where it's once floated. There must and shall be no return to tyranny or savagery," meaning anywhere the U.S. Army ever lands, we should keep. We should never retract. Now, Mark Twain was such a different figure. He had traveled the world not as a soldier, but as an individual, and he had seen in places like South Africa and South Sea Islands the oppression that European colonialism brought. So he took the exact opposite view. In fact, I can read you a quote that he made about Roosevelt, and I want to remind you that this is not a quote that was written this week. It's a quote that was written 120 years ago. "We have never had a president before who was destitute of self-respect and of respect for his high office. We've had no president before who was not a gentleman. We've had no president before who was intended for a butcher, a dive keeper, or a bully." So here you have these two antagonists, and as I put it in my book, in intriguing ways, Roosevelt and Twain were remarkably similar. Both were fervent patriots who believed the United States had a sacred mission on Earth, although they defined that mission quite differently. Both were writers and thinkers, as well as activists. Most important, both were relentless self-promoters, born performers, who carefully cultivated their public images. They loved to preach, reveled in the spotlight, and could not turn away from a crowd or a photographer. Acutely aware of each other's popularity, neither publicly denounced the other. Among friends, though, both were free with their feelings. Roosevelt said he would like to skin Mark Twain alive. Twain considered Roosevelt clearly insane and the most formidable disaster that has befallen the country since the Civil War.
I tell you, sometimes I don't know if you're talking about 1898 or 2017, but Stephen Kinzer, let me ask you, regarding Roosevelt, what was driving his overall philosophy? Because that's one of the questions I think that still plagues America is when the country is in an expansionist fervor or an interventionist fervor, is it the force of bringing democracy to the world, or is it exploitation of lands and people? What was it for Roosevelt?
It's always a combination of factors, but Roosevelt was a particular character. So he had grown up with this great fascination with war. He was a spoiled rich kid, essentially. He had never been to a school until he got to Harvard. He loved to play with naval ships in the bathtub. His father had not fought in the Civil War. He had paid someone to fight for him, and Roosevelt felt humiliated by this. As I said, he was a great war lover. When he sent his own kids off to World War I, he wrote that he hoped they would come home with some limbs missing. So he was a great war lover, and he also believed that it was America's mission to dominate the world. But something very interesting happened to Roosevelt after he became president. And it's one of the themes that I picked from this book that plays out right up into the present. So Theodore Roosevelt suddenly became president when McKinley was assassinated in 1901. At that moment, the great nation grabber of all American history was suddenly in power. Woe to any nation on which the U.S. had ever cast a covetous eye. Roosevelt could easily have proceeded to try to annex parts of Mexico, to annex Nicaragua or Guatemala, to take colonies in Africa, or cut up China and take a piece of it. But instead, after doing the one intervention in Panama at the beginning of his presidency, he never carried out another intervention in which a single life was lost. He lost excitement and enthusiasm for the expansionist project and turned to other things like regulating big business and protecting the environment. And you see this in presidents right up to Obama. They start with this great enthusiasm to use American military power. And then, as their presidencies unfold, they come to see the blowback, the trouble that it causes, and they become markedly less enthusiastic. So I find this an encouraging trend, except that I wish it wouldn't take years for each president to learn the same lesson.
Over and over and over again.
I think we may be in that position again.
Why is it that Roosevelt had those blood-boiling opinions, as you read earlier, of Twain? I mean, granted, Twain was a hugely popular writer, an influential American voice. But, you know, Roosevelt was the president.
One of the great discoveries I made in this book had to do with Mark Twain. So my big discovery in the book is that this huge debate ever happened, because it's completely fallen out of history books. But my second discovery was that the image I've been given of Mark Twain is not correct. So he's not just this wisecracking grandfather in the rocking chair on the balcony. This guy had bitter feelings about the United States, and Roosevelt really considered him a traitor. We had fighting men in the field, and Mark Twain was getting up and saying they were doing a bandit's work. They were raping other countries. They had stained America's gowns with blood. So Roosevelt, who could never tolerate any criticism of American military intervention, saw him as an enemy within, and I think would have loved to come after him even more bitterly if Twain had not been as popular as he was.
One might think he was a Bannon-esque opposition party. Well, honestly, suddenly I just had this thought, if only Mark Twain had Twitter. goodness knows what might have happened.
Mark Twain wrote some of his bitterest pieces and never published them. Actually, many of the quotes that I've found and I have in this book from Mark Twain that are the strongest and the most poisonous are not in any biography. They're not in any anthology. We have whitewashed the image of Mark Twain and taken the controversy out of him, and I'm trying to put some of it back in.
So tell me then about this. You were talking about the Senate, and I know I'm bouncing about a little bit, but I was very, very taken by what you said about this days, weeks-long debate in the Senate, which sounds unlike anything that we've had in a generation. What happened there?
In reading this debate, one of the things that struck me was, first of all, how the debates are so current. The arguments on both sides are so current. But the other thing is, the senators are so articulate. They're so sophisticated. Even the bad guys are so smart. The debate is full of references to the Catiline conspiracy and Pliny the Elder, things that no senator today would ever think about discussing. So the level of debate is hugely inspiring. And the great question they're debating is, can a country dedicated to self-rule and to the belief that all governments gain their legitimacy from the consent of the governed, go out and govern people without their consent? So here are a few little fragments from that debate. Here's one of the defenders of the expansionist project, Senator Albert Beveridge. The opposition tells us that we ought not to govern a people without their consent. I answer, the rule of liberty, that all just government derives its authority from the consent of the governed, applies only to those who are capable of self-government. So what he's really saying is white countries are okay, but darker-skinned people don't know how to do this, so we have to conquer them. Here's Henry Cabot Lodge from Massachusetts. I do not believe that this nation was raised up for nothing. I have faith that it has a great mission in the world, a mission of good, a mission of freedom. That, again, is a trope we're still hearing. And what's the response from the other Republican senator from Massachusetts, George Frisbee Hoar? You have no right at the cannon's mouth. to impose on an unwilling people your Declaration of Independence and your Constitution and your notions of freedom and notions of what is good.
You know, you mentioned Henry Cabot Lodge. I mean, we just talked about him yesterday on the show because we were talking about the Immigration Restriction League that was also very active in Boston at exactly this period of time. So, again, there's that sort of split personality of what America wanted to be or thought it was being played out in Lodge himself. He wanted to keep immigrants out, but you say he's also speaking of the great spirit of the American project.
Actually, this was one of the contradictions he had to defend. He made sure to point out that we're going to dominate other countries, but we're not going to let the people into the United States. Now, in the anti-imperialist movement, there was also an interesting split. So the principal anti-imperialists were great believers in the dignity of the human soul, and many of them had been abolitionists, and they considered it just the logical next step, that if you didn't believe a person should own another human, you could also not believe that a nation should be able to dominate another nation. But at the same time, some of the other anti-imperialists were racists from the South who said we should not expand because then inevitably those people will be coming into the United States. So you had essentially two opposite arguments against the expansionist project.
Stephen Kinzer, I want to play a little bit of tape for you here in the last couple minutes of our conversation, because one of the lessons that I draw, or maybe questions that emerge from this fantastic book of yours, is did this vigorous, eloquent sort of nationwide debate that you're talking about that happened in the early 20th century, what did it actually resolve, or did it produce a form of magical thinking in America? And I use that word very specifically because here's some tape of President George W. Bush, 2003, defending his justification for the Iraq War. Here it is.
We will help you build a peaceful and representative government that protects the rights of all citizens. And then our military forces will leave. Iraq will go forward as a unified, independent, and sovereign nation that has regained a respected place in the world.
2003. Stephen Kinzer, to me, I feel like this is the definition of America fooling itself now. And I wonder if that was one of the inevitabilities from this momentous debate that you write about that happened in the early 20th century.
In that early period, I think America lost its innocence. We realized that we would have to do terrible things in the world. We had our first torture scandal in the Philippines.
With waterboarding.
It came right from there up to now. So I do think that this desire to liberate others and free the world plays right into the missionary instinct of the United States. And I think it's part of the reason why we love the story of World War II. Was it hugely important? Of course. But the volume of books and magazines and TV shows about World War II, I think, reflects the fact that World War II shows us the way we like to think we are. We go into countries that are ruled by evil tyrannies, we make them democracies, and then we leave. But the other stories fall out of the textbooks, the ones where we crash into countries that were democracies and we turn them into tyrannies. Now, that quote from Bush is really heartbreaking when you look at what's happened to Iraq, which is exactly the opposite of what he predicted. But what's worse to me is that successive presidents don't look at that and say, you see, this is not going to work. We're now hearing about a U.S. project going into Syria. Now we're threatening Iran. Can we not realize from our past experiences how this is going to end?
Well, you wrote one of the best books about American intervention in Iran more than 50 years ago. I mean, you wrote the defining story of that, about the CIA's coup of Mossadegh and then the installation of the Shah. I mean, that should be something that the United States is acutely aware of, because we know exactly what happened due to writing like yours.
But we don't like that story because it shows how we went into a democratic country and we turned it into a dictatorship, and now Iran has been this huge anti-American force for decades. It was all as a result of our intervention. But we don't like that story. So that's why it's become a footnote. And that book about Iran, like my new book, The True Flag, are efforts to recover lost history. I'm all about trying to find stories that were huge, that really affected the world, but that we've completely forgotten. And that's my effort in this book, too.
Well, so one last question then for you. Because in the book you write, any story can be happy or sad, depending on where you end it. That perfectly describes the history of American intervention. Now, clearly, American history has not yet ended. So what do you mean by that?
Americans like to think that we can stop a story. For example, you mentioned Iran. So in 1953, we carried out a coup in Iran. It seemed like a perfect success. We got rid of a guy we didn't like, Mossadegh.
Who had been democratically elected.
Who had been elected. And we replaced him with a guy who would do everything we wanted, the Shah. So it seemed like the ideal ending. But history didn't end in 1953. There were reactions, counter-reactions. Everything spiraled out of control. The Shah became a dictator. That became an Islamic revolution. Fanatically anti-American mullahs came to power. That brought the Iran-Iraq War. That brought us into our death embrace with Saddam. That brought the Soviets into Afghanistan, which trapped us in there. So a lot of history came out of 3 weeks in Iran. And I'd like us to draw some lessons from that and realize that these projects do not wind up well either for the target country or for the United States.
So am I just stating the obvious when I ask if you are an anti-interventionist?
You're not stating anything you're asking, but yes, I am. I think there are cases when military intervention is justified. However, it never works out well. Now, there are times when not intervening would have even worse results than intervening. And in those cases, it's justified to use military force. But never go into it thinking that it's going to end up beautifully, people will throw flowers at you, and everybody will be happy. It will always end badly. It may not end as badly as the opposite, but never does military intervention produce a happy ending.
Well, Stephen Kinzer's new book is The True Flag: Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire. It is fantastic. I highly recommend it. Stephen Kinzer, thank you so very much for coming in today.
Great to be here.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.